Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
He's going to need complete rejuve if he lives that long.
Men like Bunny make the rules until someone else displaces them.
The Familius Regnant is sick, on its deathbed. And if we don't act quickly, the patient could die.
Graphic Audio presents The Serrano Legacy by Elizabeth Moon.
Miranda, I don't think it was the New Tex Militia.
I will make the Familius great, and everyone will know who saved it from destruction.
Narrated by Nanette Savard. With performances by Sonny Lasky, Colleen Delaney, Ren Casey, Stephen Carpenter, Lily Beacon, Richard Rowan, David Coyne, Sherry Simpson, Terrence Aselford, M.B. Van Dorn, Elizabeth Demery, Andy Clements, Mort Shelby, Jeff Baker, Thomas Penny, Tim Getman, Peter Stray, Elizabeth Jernigan, Michael John Casey, Casey Platt, Tom Simpson, Dylan Lynch, James Lewis, Tess Rowan, Corey James, and James Konacek. Book 6, Change of Command, Part 1.
Kevil Mahoney was aware of disturbing dreams and tried to fight his way to consciousness. He felt stiff, as if he'd been in the same position too long, and somewhere in the distance, someone hurt quite badly. Red and pink swirls slid past his vision. When he blinked, nothing happened but the addition of ugly green smears to the swirls. He thought he heard something, but, like the vague shapes that teased his eyes, the sounds were curiously unhelpful, blunt and unformed.
He's going to need complete rejuve if he lives that long.
Ice, then fire, washed through him. He never knew if it was something they did or his body's response to what he heard. His eyes opened to see a pale blur. He struggled to get his mouth open, then realized it was open, wedged with some instrument.
Lie still. Close your eyes.
Kevil was in no mood to take orders. Someone slid out the thing in his mouth.
What happened?
Memory returned in that moment, even as he asked. Even as the people he could not yet see hesitated, he knew what had happened. He and Bunny in the ground car. Bunny's face, taut and lined for so many months, finally relaxing. They had been chatting about the continuing problems resulting from the Moraline's pharmaceutical plant on Patchcock, the rising price of rejuvenations, and the political implications. And then the white flare of some weapon, and Bunny's face disappearing into a mess of red and pink and gray.
He must be dead. No one could survive that.
And he, Kevil Mahoney, was alive. At least for now, because his friend's head had taken the brunt of whatever attack. The New Texas God-fearing militia had sworn vengeance on them. Evidently, it had been no idle threat. He needed to know what had happened.
Who's in charge now? What is Fleet doing?
But he felt a dark, chilly fog rising over him and slipped into that darkness, unsure if it was death or a drug. Hobart Constalline permitted none of the emotions churning inside him to show in his face or demeanor. His secretary's expression of cautious solemnity proved he'd been successful. The silly man couldn't tell how his employer was taking the news. Good.
It's been confirmed by 3 separate agencies, Malone.
Terrible.
I suppose it was those terrorists in retaliation for the executions.
That's the speculation at this time, my lord.
How many were killed or injured?
Lord Thornbuckle and 3 security personnel killed. Sir Mahoney is alive, but in critical condition. He is not expected to live.
Oh, a terrible, terrible situation.
And terrible for some, certainly.
Bunny Thornbuckle's relatives and friends were no doubt reeling in shock and confusion. So would the whole council be, if someone didn't take hold and give the guidance that had been so sorely needed for the past several years. If Kevil Mahoney had been uninjured, they might have turned to him. But without either Bunny or Kevil, the families would mill about like panicky sheep, baaing uselessly at the wolf pack around them. He knew exactly what far-sighted, strong, decisive leader should take charge.
Send our condolences to Miranda. Inform my wife's secretary that I'm sure my wife will want to call on her.
Poor, beautiful, clever Miranda. So unlucky in her choice of men and her children. Poor Bruin, for that matter.
Like everyone who had met the child, Hobart had enjoyed her scatterbrained, madcap beauty. She had needed a good husband to settle her down, but Bunny had insisted on letting her run wild with disastrous results. Another instance of Bunny's lamentable lack of decisive, firm leadership. Nothing like that had happened to the Consuline daughters, nor ever would. Bunny's older children had turned out well enough, though young Buttons was no second Bunny. He had all his father's stuffiness and none of his father's brilliance. All the better. The last thing the Consulines needed was another Bunny Thornbuckle in that chair.
You have messages from several other families.
No doubt.
Those Hobart had been talking to, in preparation for the Grand Council meeting this year, would want to know his plans now. For an instant, the internal vision of those plans blinded him to the room around him. With Bunny and Kevil Mahoney out of the picture, with Bunny's supporters in disarray, shocked and grieving, a man who knew what he wanted and moved quickly and decisively might go farther than he had believed possible. He glanced over the messages as his secretary left the room. As he'd expected, shock, concern, fear, shock. With every passing moment, he felt more certain that he, and he alone, would have to act in this crisis. How fortunate that he had not left Castle Rock with the others.
Make a list of all the chairholders who are still on planet, and set up a conference call for the Consuline Sept. All chairholding members.
Sir, I have the list. I keep a current file on all the chairholders.
Excellent.
Hobart looked it over carefully while his secretary was arranging the complicated linkage of Ansible and ordinary communications lines for the conference call, and realized that the opportunity would never be greater. The Barraclough Sept, which included the Lesser Arranlake and Podualinair Septs, had not rallied to Bunny's side when Bruin returned. The Arranlakes, with the exception of Lady Cecilia de Marktos, had supported an Arranlake candidate, Hubert Roscoe Millander, for family head, and they'd lost. They were home sulking. The Padualinairs favored Bunny's brother Harless, who supported their claim to seniority over the Arranlakes and their ambitions in the colonial worlds. This left only a few of the Barraclughs themselves on planet, those closest to Bunny, and therefore more likely devastated by his death. Hobart glanced around the room, his gaze roaming from one proof of his eminence to another.
Would my family be devastated if I were assassinated?
Delphine would be. She would cry and cry until her pretty face was all swollen and splotched with ugly color. The girls would cry, but only for a while, he was sure. They would look for another patron, another source of favor, and another dispenser of luxuries. Fickle, that's what women were, unless you trained them well, as he had trained Delphine. The boys, though, if he had brought them up well, they would be planning already how to avenge him and how to gain more power. But he would not be assassinated. He would be more careful than Bunny, more alert to covert threats, less... not less brave, but less foolhardy. Bruin had no doubt got her foolhardy genes from him, not from prudent Miranda. His excitement mounted as he went on through the list. If he had had Bunny killed, And the thought had crossed his mind more than once in the year when it seemed that nothing else would get that great fool out of an office he was unfit to fill. He could not have chosen a better time. Best of all, he hadn't done it himself. He'd had nothing to do with it. Fate had finally come over to his side. He had proven himself capable of succeeding against the worst fate could do, and now fate, womanlike, had chosen him for that very energy and persistence and will to triumph. He closed his eyes a moment, allowing himself the luxury of imagining the moment when he took over as speaker, when the faces which had ignored or turned away turned to him, had to turn to him, and he could finally show his true abilities.
I will make the Familius great, and everyone will know who saved it from destruction.
I didn't know they would take it out of my pay.
Ensign Baron Serrano tried to hide the distress in his voice, but his entire paycheck was gone. Nothing in his credit cube, and he'd already ordered the traditional engagement and wedding gifts.
Well, who do you think would pay for it? Those people have already used up the sector discretionary fund and most of the recreational reserve. And they're not even charging you for all of them, just the ones your pay will cover.
10 dependents.
That would eat up all his pay after he was promoted, too. Baron supposed he should count himself lucky that fleet regulations prohibited official indebtedness.
And I'm not even married. How could they do this to me?
Look at it this way, sir. It'll keep you out of trouble.
No, not really. I just sent in my order for the wedding.
Well, sir...
Attention all hands! Attention all hands!
A pause, during which Baron tried to think how to get himself out of his present financial fix.
It is my sad duty to announce that the Speaker of the Table of Ministers has been assassinated. Stand by.
Baron stared at the chief, who stared back.
The Speaker assassinated? Where? How? And what'll happen to Brunn and all those women?
Lieutenant Sweezer, there's a flash priority message. Cobalt encryption.
Esme Sweezer's mind had drifted, as it did often these days, to Baron.
Oh, right. Well, keep a link to the Ansible, and I'll get the captain.
The last priority message had been medical, directing them to relieve senior NCOs with rejuve of duty. But they had none aboard. Maybe this one would be useful. What she wanted was a message from Baron, preferably with a friendly reaction from his family. Being on two different ships really hampered communication. She hoped they could meet in person for a few days. Captain Solis knew she was due leave. He had already said she could take the time off, but she'd heard nothing so far. Captain Solis, never talkative this early in first shift, became even more still after the encrypted message had gone to his console. Esme glanced over.
Sir?
I said nothing, Lieutenant. Lord Thornbuckle is dead. Assassinated. Presumably, it's the New Texas Militia in retaliation for our execution of their rangers.
A pause, during which Esme did her best not to ask the question that hammered at her mind.
Lieutenant, you can count on all leaves being canceled. I'm sorry. There are some things more urgent than a wedding.
It won't hurt to do the paperwork.
Solis gave her a long look.
Good idea. Then if you get the chance... But in the meantime, I want a threat assessment. Get started on that while I make the announcement to the crew. Attention all hands! Attention all hands! This is the captain. I have this moment received an encrypted message from Fleet Headquarters. I regret to inform all of you that Speaker of the Grand Council, Lord Thornbuckle, is dead. Assassinated on Castle Rock. We will now observe 1 minute of silence and respect for the Speaker of the Grand Council.
Silence dragged on. Longer than a minute, it felt like. Esme wondered how Brunn was holding up. She had not had time to recover from her captivity, and already she had lost her father. Esme murmured prayers she had not thought of in years.
Memorandum to the Chief of Personnel from the Chief Medical Services. Urgent, you refer all enlisted personnel who received rejuvenation treatment within the past 10 years to medical immediately. Make no exceptions. If necessary, refer in order of rejuvenation.
Admiral Vita Serrano, now securely in command of Sector 7, scanned the memorandum, very aware of the tension in Master Chief Valdos's shoulders. She herself had forwarded the concerns of Baron and Captain Escobar about mental deterioration in senior enlisted personnel under the tightest security. She had followed the subsequent medical investigation, but the details eluded her. Rejuvenation neurobiology was not her field. She needed to be briefed on it, and so far, despite several increasingly firm requests to Fleet Headquarters, no such briefing had taken place.
How can I reassure Valdos and others under my command without the information I need? What will happen if I can't? Get me the heads of personnel and medical. We have a situation I don't fully understand, and I want to be sure we handle this with both discretion and fairness.
Sir, if the Admiral permits.
Go ahead.
Is it true they're looking for ways to bump out senior NCOs? An excuse not to offer any more rejuvenations?
Just the kind of ideas she did not want floating around.
In my opinion, Chief, and it's only my opinion, but I do have some data. This may have to do with medical problems from a bad batch of rejuve drugs.
Problems?
Yes. I'm not going to blacken anyone's name because I don't know all the facts. I'm not a medical officer. I do know that investigation of something else revealed a source of contaminated rejuve drugs, and there was concern that they might have made it into our supply chain. Meanwhile, several senior NCOs began showing neurological symptoms within a few months to a year of each other, widely separated in their duty stations, and not all in the same branch.
Could they have given us bad drugs? To justify later refusal to rejuve?
On purpose?
Valdos nodded.
Oh, absolutely not. If that's what happened, I suspect it is a simple mistake. Or if not, an enemy wished to deprive us of our most valuable senior NCOs in order to make a strike easier.
I hope you're right, sir.
He went out, shaking his head. She hoped she was right, too, and that he believed her. If the NCOs started worrying about whether they had been given bad drugs intentionally, the close-knit community of Fleet could unravel with fatal speed. On a cold, windy day in local autumn, the prisoners of Stack Island's military prison on Copper Mountain were drawn up in ranks to witness another change of command ceremony from behind barriers of both steel and invisible force shields. In front of it, in the small enclosed parade ground, all but a few of the guards were also in formation, uneasily aware of the prisoners' gazes fixed on their backs. No matter that a force shield lay between them, nothing protected them from the malevolence. Up in front, Josep Tolan relinquished his command to Pilar Bakarian with relief. He had not enjoyed any moment of his stay in that exile from his former sphere of power, and he had to agree to take early retirement to get out of it. Pilar, though, he would be very glad to put the width of the big ocean and later some deep space between himself and one of the few women who had ever been close to Admiral Lupescu. On her part, Commander Pilar Bakarian felt an almost physical surge of pleasure in the tension on Tolan's face. He not only disliked her, he was afraid of her. He should be. They all should be, and they would be, in time. She smiled at Tolan, letting him see that she recognized his fear, and saw the glisten of sweat on his forehead even in the cold. Then she released him from her gaze and turned it instead on her subordinates. They did not flinch. She had not thought they would. Their gaze challenged her, the first female commander this prison had ever had. Was she tough enough, their gaze asked? Could she do the job? Others, whose identities she already knew, had no doubts about her toughness. They were well aware that Lupescu had been her mentor, that she had supported his agenda. Carefully disguised in her duffel were slivers of the ears she had taken. When it had become imprudent to keep these proofs of her status, She had sliced them thin herself and found hiding places for them. She had hunted, in the oldest hunt of all. She had killed. She had survived the hunt on Cerealis, having left to take command of a ship before the game ended with Lopescu dead, and Harris Serrano once more in favor with Fleet Brass. But no one knew it. They were all dead, and the prisoners she'd hunted had never seen her face. Her luck was strong, and her skills... She would match her skills against Serrano directly someday. She knew she would win. She looked past the guards, past the force screen, to the prisoners in their drab ranks. In there, she also had potential allies.
In time.
Tolan left at last in the air car. Pilar wished him a nasty storm on the way to the mainland, but it didn't really matter. Let him live, and let him realize someday just what he'd seen in their brief exchange. The ceremony over, Pilar summoned her staff. They were unwise enough to look surprised. She allowed herself a tight smile on the way to her office, thinking how soon they would learn what she was like. On the mainland, at main base, autumn had not yet modulated a brutally hot summer. It had been a dry year, and now fine reddish dust turned the sky dirty brown as the wind lifted it high into the atmosphere. In this kind of weather, everyone who could get off base privileges spent hours in Q-Town's bars, drinking whatever was coldest. Even combat veterans accepted the crowd in their favorite watering hole. It was too hot and too miserable to complain. Margu Pardalt, newly graduated from the academy and the only Xavierine in her class, had a habit of coming tops in her classes. She had to. She had to do something to make up for her sister Mazu, killed by raiders years ago. Mazu had been the family genius. Brilliant, brave, everything a family could hope for. Margu was second best, and knew it. A poor replacement for the fallen hero. So it was up to her to make her mark, to be Mazu's memorial. Her place in the academy had been a gift from the Familius in memory of Mazu. Her place in the universe was to be her gift in return. She had earned an evening's liberty by coming first in her class yet again at Copper Mountain, and she thought it fitting that her free hours came at a time when no rational person could enjoy them. She'd have stayed in her quarters, but her training CO had told her to get off the base, and orders were orders. Another gust of wind streamed down Q-Town's main street and filled her nose with hot stinging dust, and her eyes watered. It reminded her too much of the benignity scorch of Xavier, when she and her family had wrapped torn sheets around their heads for weeks to filter the dust and ash. Ahead on the right, she spotted a doorway just opening as someone came out, and a gush of cooler air brushed her side. She turned into it. It was only moderately crowded, less crowded than the two bars she'd glanced into and left, and smelled of food as much as drink. Margu made her way to one of the open booths and slid in, then looked around. The tables and seats looked a little strange, until she realized they were meant to look like ship parts. No, they were ship parts. Her quick glance took in the long, dark bar, obviously hull material. The models, obviously military vessels. The battle honors hung on the walls, the photographs. It was a shrine, then. Margu felt obscurely comforted and lowered her head to pray for the dead and the survivors alike. Her family were Cinerines. She had learned the right forms for valediction and commemoration from early childhood.
Do you need help?
Margu looked up to find herself face to face with a man in a float chair.
No, sir. I was honoring the dead.
His brows rose, crinkling the skin around the scars on his bald scalp.
You knew about this place?
No, sir. But it's obvious.
May I have the honor of your name?
Ensign Pardalt, from Xavier.
He looked her over carefully.
Ah, Xavier. You were at the academy when the...
No, sir. I was home. On Xavier, I mean.
Margu knew already that to fleet personnel, fleet was home. And the planet of origin was just that. The planet of origin.
And you survived the benignity. Your family as well?
Most of them.
You're welcome here anytime, Ensign. You've earned it.
But she hadn't earned anything. Not yet. The way she saw it, everything she had, Mazyu had earned. Still, she was not going to contradict someone like this, a combat veteran.
Thank you.
She hoped she'd read the signals right.
May I offer you a drink?
She saw a reaction, but she wasn't sure what.
As it is your first time in my establishment, I hope you'll honor me by accepting one.
She dipped her head.
I would be honored.
Then, as he waited, she realized he wanted her to name it. She wasn't used to that, but she glanced at the menu display and chose a dark ale spiced with ginger. When the mug arrived, heavily frosted, it came with a bowl of raw vegetable sticks on shaved ice.
If you like spiced ales, I thought you might like these.
Margu nibbled one. It had a refreshing bite. He sipped his own drink, watching her over the rim. She found it disconcerting.
We had Lieutenant Sweeza in here when she was on a course.
That name she knew, of course. Sweeza had been added to her family's prayers, and she had heard a lot about Sweeza in the academy and after.
I never met her, but we owe her a lot.
You remind me of her. She's quiet, too.
Oh, she's a real hero. I'm just a very green ensign.
You might surprise yourself.
Margu did fantasize about that sometimes, but she knew it was ridiculous. She could be serious, careful, diligent, prudent. And none of those were heroic virtues, as she understood heroism. The news vid, Lady Cecilia's pleasant, bony, somewhat horse-like face, beneath rumpled red-gold curls, then a shot of her exercising seniority over fences, the horse's gleaming red coat only a shade darker than her hair, then a shot of them over the last fence of the Stavenge. The video shifted to Liamar Dahi, guiding Plantagenet over the Warren Trials B-Course Big Drop Bridge combination the year before, freezing on the instant before landing while the commentator recited their previous record. Cecilia grimaced at the display. Like any expert rider, she could find flaws in everything she did, and would have much preferred to have the vid show her over the 17th fence, where she and seniority had made neat work of a difficult combination, than that last fence, where seniority had jumped flat, and her own hand position showed why. She'd lost concentration for a crucial few seconds.
Why was I thinking about Pader Origamos and the rejuvenants and not fence 30?
Two days later, Cecilia brought seniority in from the gallops in exactly the shape she wanted. Pulse and respiration had recovered beautifully, and he could have gone another mile without strain. But any more fitness now, and he would peak before the senior trials.
No. A long hack this afternoon, then tomorrow...
Sassy, have you heard?
Colum was waiting for her at the entrance to the gallops, as he usually did. Cecilia loosened the strap of her helmet and pushed back under it the one lock of red hair that always managed to get loose and tickle her forehead.
What?
Lord Thornbuckle's been killed. It's on all the news vids.
Bunny?
A swift montage of pictures ran through her mind. Bunny at the head of the table. Bunny on horseback on opening day of the hunt season. Bunny taking over from Kemtree at the Grand Council. Bunny and Kevil heads together, discussing something.
It can't be.
They say it might be those terrorists.
Reality came back as seniority reached down to rub his face on his leg and yanked the reins. Cecilia blinked, looked around, saw the subdued flurry of activity near the barns. The first acid bite of sadness seeped through the shock. If it was true, this was going to hurt a lot. Colum seemed to understand that she could say nothing. He flung a cooler over the horse's back and put a hand to the rein. Cecilia sat there as he led seniority on into the aisle between the barns, where the look on the groom's faces told her that the news vids were playing this straight. Roz, her head groom, met her. She slid down, ran the stirrups up, automatically coordinating with the groom as they untacked the chestnut horse and began the after-workout rubdown.
You heard?
Yes.
You knew him, didn't you?
Already past tense.
Yes, for a long time.
It's terrible. It said on the news there wasn't even enough left for a neuroscan. No chance.
Cecilia didn't want to hear this. She didn't want to think about this. Her rejuvenated body felt alien suddenly, the reverse of the way she had felt when her young mind lived in her old one. Now she felt trapped in a body that could not feel what she felt emotionally.
Do you think they'll cancel the trials?
I doubt it. They didn't stop the trials when Kemtree abdicated.
But even as she said it, she felt uneasy.
Whether the trials go on or not, should I ride? What's the right thing to do?
She paused in her strokes down Seniority's muscled haunch to calculate travel times. She could not possibly make it to Castle Rock for any memorial service, even if she gave up the competition.
That being so, what good would it do Bunny for me to withdraw? What good would it do someone else?
She stood watching as Roz and Jerry began sponging the horse down, wondering why that had come to mind. Why, at some level, she did not believe that awful militia group had killed Bunny.
But who else? And how am I going to find out?
Dale, her trainer, had Max in tow.
Ceci, I know, it's awful, but this guy needs to be ridden.
Cecilia wanted to say she couldn't, but she knew she could. And whatever happened to humans, horses needed their unbroken routine. She let a groom give her a leg up onto Max and headed back to the gallops. As always, just being on a horse in motion cleared her mind. Max was no seniority, but he was maturing into a very nice ride over short distances, and he would bring a good price when the time came. If the time came, with Bunny dead.
Who knows what that means politically?
She didn't, though she had paid more attention than she used to. Bunny had been a good executive, except perhaps for his frenzy when Brun was taken, a frenzy no one could blame. Things had gone well. Her investments had prospered. And if hers prospered, then surely the economy was doing well. Except for the volatility in rejuvenation pharmaceuticals, which had pretty much smoothed out this past year. The Consulines had lost face and market share, but they certainly weren't ruined.
And what about Miranda and Brun? Will they move back to Cerealis? Will they... Damn it, will they still have fox hunting?
That wasn't the important thing, of course. The important thing was finding out who had killed Bunny and dealing with him. Or her. Max took advantage of his rider's wandering mind and shied at a rustle in the hedge beside the field. Cecilia caught him before he could bolt and sent him on firmly. Best think about the horse. That was something she could control. For the rest of the two-hour hack, she managed to keep her sorrow and her worries at bay. They returned when she handed Max over to the grooms. Roz looked almost as grim as she felt. She had worked two seasons on Cerealis, Cecilia remembered, and had a scrapbook on the Thornbuckle family.
It'll never be the same. Young Buttons is a fine man, but he's not his father.
No. But Kevil will help him.
He was hurt too, you know. Really bad. He might die.
Kevil Mahoney?
That's what the news vid said. If you can trust them. Damn those terrorists anyway. I don't know why they have to make more trouble in the world as if there's not enough.
Lady Cecilia, you have a caller.
The last thing Cecilia wanted. She turned away, leaving Roz and the new girl working on Max, and stripped off her gloves, tucking them in her belt. Pater Origamos was lounging in the stable office, flipping through the stable feed records.
Get out of that.
Cecilia herself had sneaked a look at the hay receipts for other owners, wondering if they had a better source. Everyone snooped in stable offices.
You're looking splendid. Still, terrible news. Terrible news.
Yes, it is. I'm still not really grasping it.
I came over because I knew you'd been close to both of them.
Both of them?
Bunny and Kevil, I mean. At least, that's what the word was the past few years. People were even twitting young George about it.
About me and Kevil?
And why not?
Kevil and I are friends. Friends, not lovers.
Well, only twice, after which they'd both agreed it wasn't working nearly as well as they'd hoped.
Yes, I spent a lot of time with him after my rejuvenation because I needed his legal advice to untangle my affairs. But that's all.
Well, a friend, then. But still, I was sure you'd be upset, so I came over to check on you.
Disgusting little climber.
Yes, he was rich, and yes, his family was seated. But he was, compared to her, a minor twig on the very large and ancient Consuline elm. Her branch of the Aran Lake Sept made up a much greater percentage of the even larger and older Barraclough Oak. Cecilia pushed that back down. She wasn't the sort of person who worshipped a family tree. People didn't get to choose their parentage. Pater's mannerisms, more pronounced in old age and despite several rejuvenations, had been there from the day she first met him at someone's birthday party. He wanted to be a protector. Bad luck for him, she didn't need protecting.
"I'm fine, Pater. I'll be fine. I'll grieve, and then I'll get over it."
"Why don't you let me take you to dinner?"
As so often, the kind impulse that was exactly wrong.
"Not tonight, please. I just want to go back and cry a little. Another time, perhaps."
Pater bowed politely.
"I'll hold you to it."
"Go away."
Cecilia held a polite smile that made her face ache. He bowed again and left. She and Bunny had laughed about Pater from time to time, trusting each other not to share that fact. His stiff little bows, his exaggerated courtesies, his passion for antique clothing and sports even more useless than fox hunting and eventing. She would never have Bunny to laugh with again. She would never see that long, foolish face come alight with intelligence, with his quick wit. She would never warm herself at the glow of the love between Bunny and Miranda, a love she had watched grow and deepen over the many decades she'd known them both. Tears ran down her face, and when Dale came back to the office, she was curled into the big chair and didn't hear him step in, then quietly close the door behind him when he left again. The day of Bunny's funeral dawned clear and cold. Miranda woke before dawn and watched the light seep into the eastern sky. She lay still beneath the covers, feeling the weight of them, reluctant to leave that warm nest and face what would be a long and difficult day. Their room, her room, was not cold, but she had not felt warm since that first horrible moment when they'd told her Bunny was dead.
"Damn it."
She had chosen that music herself to wake to. She reached over and punched up the volume, then threw off the covers in one angry gesture. Bunny was dead. Nothing would change that. Not the music, not the dawn, not whatever mood she was in. Beneath her feet, the carpet was still soft and thick. Around her shoulders, the fleecy jacket warmed her. Bunny was dead. She was alive and beautiful. She heard people whispering, and after all, it was true. And very, very wealthy. Wealthy and the grandmother of bastards whose fathers were, if not dead, criminals, and no doubt partners of those who had killed Bunny. Miranda had not told Bunny how she felt about those babies. Grandmothers were supposed to have a natural love for grandchildren, but she could not see those boys as anything but vandalism perpetrated on her daughter. Bunny had seen it differently. Bunny had assumed she would love them if Brun couldn't. Bunny had assumed she would organize their care. Bunny was dead. She stood, unable to move for a long moment. It wasn't supposed to be like this. People their age were supposed to be adult, mature, stable. They were resigned to loss, said the books she'd read. She wasn't resigned. She wanted to shake her fist and scream at the sky. She wanted to fall off a cliff and drown. The secret was that the rich had hearts, too. She had loved Bunny the way girls in romance story cubes loved their heroes, and 40 years of marriage had not changed that. And he was dead. And she was alive, with children and grandchildren and bastard grandchildren who were not at fault for their father's sins, and a daughter still healing from what had been done to her, and all Bunny's hopes and dreams for the peace of the world crashing down around them, shattered. When her maid came in later, Miranda smiled and calmly accepted a cup of tea, which she drank with perfect composure while her maid ran her bath. Brun Meager had wakened even earlier when the twins cried, as they often did, in the middle of the night. They should be sleeping through the night, the nursemaid said, but they hadn't done so more than one night in four since they were taken from Our Texas. And Brunn had discovered, to her annoyance, that when they woke, she also woke, even if someone else was doing the feeding and cleaning. She used the time to exercise, the exercises she never skipped these days. By the time her maid knocked, she had already worked herself into a sweat and showered herself back to normal. In the mirrors of the bath, her face stared back at her, strange after nearly two standard years without a mirror. An older face, a harder face, but, in spite of everything, a face of memorable beauty. Something would have to be done about that, but not today. Today she would walk with her mother, her brothers, her older sister, in the funeral procession. Today she would hold her head high in the face of the universe. They had forced her to bear their children. They could not force her to hide. Colonel Bydarlin had not slept all night. Organizing a state funeral had always been, would always be, a nightmare of protocol and endless complicated detail. But ordinarily, a state funeral was not mixed with a top-level security concern. Even when a head of state was assassinated, that usually ended the threat.
Only 23.87% of political assassinations in the past 500 years have been followed by subsequent assassinations.
But this was different. The other branches of the new Texas God-fearing militia had specifically threatened Lord Thornbuckle and his family, with additional threats to Hazel Takaris, the Rangers' wives and female dependents, and several members of the regular space service, including Admiral Vida Serrano. Fleet, Colonel Bydarlin thought, could protect its own. As chief of security for Castle Rock, his responsibility was the safety of the civilians, specifically those who would be present, vulnerable, in the funeral procession. His predecessor, Colonel Harris, was even now trying to explain why they had not taken sufficient precautions, why Lord Thornbuckle had died, and no one, not one single militia member or sympathizer, had been captured. He would have to assume they'd try again. He would have to assume that everything Harris had done was wrong, that Harris had missed something vital. Unless it wasn't the new Texas God-fearing militia after all. Bydarlin's head lifted, as if scenting game.
What if it was someone else? Someone trying to use the new text as a cover?
In that case, the funeral would probably go off without a hitch, which at the moment was all he cared about. Brunn eyed her mother as they came out onto the porch, into the cold sunlight. Security, dark-uniformed and obviously armed, hovered around them. Five cars, all identical, polished burgundy with black and gold trim, awaited them.
Five? Security. Four of them are drags.
Four would lay false trails, though since everyone knew where the funeral would be held, Brunn didn't see how that would help. She could at least notice who was here and who had not been able to, or wanted to, come. No Lady Cecilia. Well, it was the Warren trials, after all, and she might not even have heard yet. Her sister Berenice, though, and her brother Abelard. No Rafa or Ronnie. Absurd how she missed them. Rafa's Aunt Marta Saenz, such a support to her father while she was missing. Her mother's report of that had been just a touch acidic. Had gone back to her own world as soon as Brunn returned. No George. But of course, the odious George had his own critically wounded father to watch over. Of their own sept, her father's younger brother Harless and his son Kel, who didn't look to have improved from her last memory of him. A whole raft of Consulines, most of whom she didn't know well enough to put names to, and Venezia Moraline. In ordinary times, not that the death of her father would ever have been ordinary, Kevil Mahoney would have given the eulogy. Instead, it was her uncle, Harless.
A fine man. A man with strong family loyalties to his children. And a man of great abilities who had perhaps not quite lived up to them.
Bollocks.
That was a great-great-uncle in the Barraclough main line. He took the floor next, praising Bunny the way Brunn had expected him to be praised. That was the father she remembered. Generous, loyal, intelligent, capable. Others followed. Political friends, describing how Lord Thornbuckle's tactful but firm handling of the government had held it together when Kemtree abdicated. Political enemies, praising with delicate cuts at her father's occasional mistakes, and being so tactful in ignoring the obvious one that Bruin found herself the target of one covert glance after another. If it hadn't been for her, if it hadn't been for her idiot rashness, her father would still be alive and in power, and these sly critics would be silent. She glanced down at her mother's hands and saw the knuckles whitening the skin, though Miranda's face betrayed nothing. Guilt, sorrow, shame, and a deep, deep anger. It was her fault, in part, but it was not all her fault. Their maneuvering, their use of her misfortune and her father's death, that was their responsibility. She had been determined to go away, to change herself into someone else, and break the connection with the rash young Bruin who fell into captivity. But watching her father's enemies, enemies she had not known he had, at her father's funeral, that resolve weakened. Prima Bui sat embroidering a collar with a row of tiny green leaves and kept a sharp eye on her household. It was hard to realize that only a short time ago she had been Prima Bui in truth, Mitch's first wife and mother of nine children, with a real household to manage, a household with a garden and weaving shed, with courtyards for the children and servants and tutors. Now she was Prima Bui on her new Familius identity card, because that's what Hazel had told them. And even Hazel didn't know that wasn't a name, but a title. She had been called Ruth Ann in childhood, long before she was any man's prima. But no one had called her that since her father died. And Mitch's last name wasn't Bui. That was his title. He was really a Pardue. So her name ought to be Ruth Ann Pardue.
Should I tell someone? It would not be fitting to be called Prima Serrano when that young woman becomes his first wife.
She knew that, even as she hated the thought of being second or third behind such a young thing. And what was worse, a heathen abomination who was actually in the military.
Prima?
She looked up to see Simplicity in the doorway.
Hazel's here, Mama. Prima.
Simplicity had never learned not to call her Mama. Prima wished again that Mitch had not made such a fuss about it. But he had, and she'd had to send the child to the servants' hall even before she was out of the Virgin's Bower. It occurred to Prima that now she could reverse that decision.
It's all right to call me Mama here, Simplicity.
Mama? But the Ranger...
isn't here. You may say Mama.
Simplicity ran over, just like the small child she was inside, and hugged Prima clumsily.
I love you, Mama!
Prima patted the girl on the shoulder.
I love you, Simplicity. There now. Go to the kitchen and bring us some lemonade.
Yes, Mama.
Simplicity had always been biddable and sweet. Prima could not help wishing Mitch had appreciated that sweetness more.
Prima?
Prima pushed the needle through her work and laid it aside.
Yes. Come in and have a seat. What is the news?
You could turn on a vid.
Full of nonsense, all that arguing and bad language, too.
Prima didn't mention the other things she found there by accident. Men and women with no clothes on, doing things she had never imagined they could do.
Lord Thornbuckle's funeral was today.
Prima knew that. Everyone knew that. Even with the vid turned off, there was no way to avoid knowing that the Speaker of the Table of Ministers, whose daughter had started all the troubles, had died and was being... not buried, because they didn't do that here, but whatever they called it today.
It was all his fault, really.
Prima wanted to believe that. Wanted to believe that if that one arrogant blonde man had not been so bad a father that his daughter had fallen into captivity, then she would still be Prima Bui, first wife of a ranger, safe and happy in the household she had known, had helped make since her wedding. That was a comfortable thought.
All his fault. And Mitch, the innocent dupe of heathens. Me, an innocent victim. The children, oh.
Try as she might, she could not convince herself, quite, that it was all Lord Thornbuckle's fault. Or even his daughter's. though she loathed the tall, yellow-haired woman.
Prima, I'm sorry, but I really need to talk to you about your plans.
My plans? What do you mean?
Everyone wants to know what you're going to do. About the children's schooling, about supporting yourself.
Supporting myself!
Prima fastened on that. She was not about to discuss sending the children out to one of the heathen schools.
But the Serranos promised protection.
Protection, yes. But there are hundreds of you all told. They can't afford to support all of you. And there are laws about the children, about schooling.
I am not sending my children to some heathen school to be taught violence.
There are religious schools. I brought you a cube.
A cube, which she could access only with a cube reader. A machine. Machines, the Parsons had always said, would make women lazy.
I need to change my name.
Hazel looked surprised.
I'm not Mitch's Prima anymore. Ruth Ann was my birth name, and I should be Ruth Ann again.
Ruth Ann. It's a pretty name.
Sounds strange to me. No one's called me that since my parents, years ago.
Didn't they keep calling you?
No! I was Prima Pardue from the day I married Mitch, and Prima Bowie from the day he became Ranger.
Prima fidgeted a bit, wishing she didn't have to ask what she wanted to know.
Hazel, I never see anyone like Simplicity, even on the vid, when I do watch it. Surely your people have children that turn out not quite right?
Not many. I know you don't like to hear it, but people do tests and medical treatment even before babies are born to be sure nothing is wrong with them. Then, if something happens during pregnancy or birth, they fix it.
Fix it? How can you fix a mind?
I don't know. I'm still young. I haven't finished my schooling, and I never studied any medicine.
Could they fix Simplicity now?
I don't think so. I can ask, but I think they have to be younger. But Prima, Ruth, I mean, there's no need to fix Simplicity. She's a sweet, loving person the way she is.
Your people don't value sweetness. They value intelligence.
There are many places in the Familius where that's true. But there are also many places that will value Simplicity for her gentleness, her kindness. I think you misjudge us. If you want to find a place...
No! I don't want to send her away. That's what Mitch said.
That's what Mitch had done. It still hurt her that Simplicity had had to endure months in that nursery away from the home she loved.
I didn't mean send her away. I mean go with her to a place where she'd be welcome.
Oh, I can't go anywhere without Ensign Serrano's permission.
You could tell him what you want.
Hazel, you know I can't do that. He's my, well, not husband the way he should be, but he's our protector. It is for him to decide what to do with us.
That's not how it works here. He'd probably be delighted if you found a place where you and the others could be happy.
I don't know how to do that. I don't know where to start.
You could ask Professor Meyerson.
Waltroud? What could she know about other worlds?
She's a professor. Finding things out is what she does best.
Could you explain it?
Prima was much more comfortable with Hazel, even Hazel in men's pants, than with Waltroud in a dress. Waltroud looked at them as if they were carrots and beets and potatoes on the kitchen table, as if she were considering how they would fit in a stew.
If she comes back in time. Prima, one thing I came to tell you. I'm leaving later today. I should be on my way to the ship now. Clearing customs is going to take longer than usual. I'm going back to my family.
Oh.
She had known in a way that Hazel would leave, as the former captive women had left. Those women, she still worried about them. But they had all insisted on going, some to restorative surgery, others with voice synthesizers, back to their families if they had any, or a life of independence that Prima could not imagine wanting.
I'll miss you, Hazel.
You were good to me.
Hazel came to hug her. Prima could feel the girl's young breasts now. Hazel was breeding age, but she would not breed. She would do, might have already done, terrible things to herself so that she would have no babies until much later. She might already be an abomination. Yet Hazel was a good girl, honest, kind, gentle. She had been so desperately worried about the two little girls in the beginning. She had been so sweet to all the children. If she'd been Prima's daughter, Prima would have been proud of her. But now she'd go off to some school or fly on a ship or... Prima could not even imagine all the possibilities.
God's blessing on you.
It went against everything Prima had been taught, offering a blessing to a heathen. She wanted to tell Hazel not to use any abominable technology, but she knew that was futile. The girl was the product of that technology. Her family used it. She would use it too. She prayed silently that God would keep Hazel safe. The chief medical officer touched the display controls, and blurred blots of color sharpened into focus.
We now know what happened, Admiral. The Surgeon General's office sent this out by Ansible. In a normal rejuvenation, on the left, the metabolites of the rejuve drugs are each involved in scavenging specific degradation products.
In plain language?
Vita Serrano knew, and knew they knew, what was meant. But she was determined to make them say it in language that anyone could understand. She had already been briefed, very secretly, by Marta Caterina Sines.
The rejuve drugs break down in the body into other chemicals. And those chemicals, metabolites, bind to and remove the chemical compounds characteristic of aging.
Very well.
In a normal rejuvenation, that leaves only healthy, undegraded tissues as a matrix for replication, the second part of the rejuvenation process.
So the first part throws out the old, as it were, and then the second part builds up the new?
Yes, Admiral. But on the right, if you'll look right here, you can see that these tissues, which stain green, are not being removed. No green on the left, and green...
On the right. Yes. And I presume that means that age-deteriorated tissues are left in the matrix when the rejuve proceeds.
Exactly. Which replicate into age-deteriorated tissues, so that after some years, it depends on the amount of deterioration in the original, as well as the exact kind of faulty drug, the deterioration affects brain function like any other senile dementia.
So, how do you fix it?
Unfortunately, we don't know. It appears that if no actual functional degradation has occurred, then a rejuvenation with good drugs produces a fresh start. But when we tried that on one of the first patients, it didn't work. The body rejuvenated to a young age, but the mental function stayed the same. We have been observing him for months now, and while the deterioration has not progressed, it has also not improved.
What about other treatments? Surely you had something for this kind of problem before rejuve.
No, not really. Admiral, I know that nobody likes to hear this, but medical miracles are rarely miracles.
How early can you detect the problem?
Within a year of a bad rejuve, which is plenty of time to correct it. But the tests take weeks. Maybe we can speed it up later, but not yet. And we have a lot of people to test.
What are we going to do with those whose rejuves failed, who've already been damaged? Rejuvenate them to youthful bodies and senility of mind? Who will take care of them? For how long? Or let them die?
Neither horn of the dilemma seemed tenable, and for once Vita was glad that it wasn't her decision. Let the Grand Admiral and the Surgeon General figure it out. The mathematics of equity in this escaped her. For dinner, Pater had chosen Raymond's, that year's fashionable restaurant. She steered him away from discussing the Zenebra trials 2 days away. He wanted her to dissect all the other competitors for his amusement.
It's not right. They are my friends as well as my fellow competitors. It's not honorable to pick them apart like that.
She touched the table controls and brought up the chessboard.
Let's play.
Don't be naive, Cecilia.
She couldn't tell whether Pater had rejuved again. He still dressed more like an actor in some deep historical play.
There's no place in real life for honor. In sports, perhaps.
He picked up a black knight and a white and made them bow to each other.
But even you know that what really matters is winning.
He clashed the pieces together.
If you break the rules, they eliminate you.
Then you might say that Bunny broke the rules.
You...
Cecilia... The rules are on a different level when you're talking about realities. Surely you know that. Men like Bunny make the rules until someone else displaces them.
He pushed the White King along the board, knocking the other pieces askew, until it rested on the edge of the board.
Yet there are always rules beyond rules. The rules that keep a man in his place, or move him away.
His finger touched the game piece. It teetered a moment on the edge of the table, then fell. I see. Cecilia didn't understand about Bunny yet. What rules he had broken that brought this man and his faction to the desperate action they had taken. She didn't understand why he had hinted so broadly, or what he expected her to do about it.
I do wonder what, if anything, the new Texas God-fearing militia has to do with rejuvenance.
Pater relaxed, just that fraction which told her she had chosen the safer alternative at that conversational fence.
People need something to blame for their disappointments. As some opportunities are foreclosed, others must be seen to open, or unrest might become general.
Again, he waited for her, that indulgent smile which told her he expected her to be slow to understand. She hated that patience. If this was what she would become as a rejuvenant, she might just as well run her horse over a cliff and be done with it.
I see what you mean, Peda. Those who cannot afford rejuvenation, or who are simply impatient, see ahead of them a lifetime of blocked opportunities. Blocked by the rejuvenants. But the universe is large. If they are discontented and ambitious enough, there are colony worlds.
Theft is always more profitable. Until the thief is caught.
That's...
She was about to say ridiculous when a tension in Pater's face silenced her. She had too much to think about, and she did not really want to think about any of it. Of what use were her wealth and her skills and her rejuvenated body if she couldn't do what she liked without having to worry about the rest of the universe? What she had wanted, what she hoped to gain, was a long life full of her own particular pleasures, which began, though they did not end, in that stable block on Rotterdam, which centered on horses and the people who had identified themselves as horse people since long before humans left old Earth. She reminded herself that she had time for both now. No longer need she fear the advancing years, the aging of joints and bones that would make her slower, clumsier. She could afford to spend a few months now dealing with whatever complication Pater meant, without losing it. But she didn't want to. And Pater knew that.
What a toad he is, after all.
He would dangle some conspiracy in front of her for his own amusement, sure that she could not concentrate on anything but horses for long enough to learn anything dangerous or do anything. He had turned the conversation back to the trials, to her chances and his.
I think you're quite right to ride, anyway. After all, it's too late to attend any ceremony.
The horse is ready, and so am I. You're staying, too.
For the same reasons. I'm ready, my horse is ready, and my competition is here.
And because it gave him a strong apparent alibi, while someone had plotted Bunny's assassination, Pater had been very publicly visible a very long way away, supervising his horse in training for the senior trials. Cecilia knew it would have been possible to have it done. Anyone knew that. But finding and proving the links would be more difficult and dangerous. Cecilia was, she discovered on the day, more ready than she knew for this particular event. While nothing could make the senior trials effortless, she was hardly aware of the effort she exerted. Seniority reacted well to her detached calmness and put in faultless cross-country and stadium rounds, which in the end were enough to win when the dressage leader, also faultless in cross-country, had a rail down the next day. Liam Ardahi had to withdraw during the cross-country when Plantagenet refused the water repeatedly. Cecilia wondered if that were entirely an accident. Plantagenet had always been bowled into water. But if Pater wanted her distracted by a major win... He was ruthlessly competitive, but he had won a much larger competition, as he saw it. She smiled for the press on her victory gallop and remembered to thank all her staff, enclosing a personal note with the bonus credit each received.
reception that evening, she wore her amber necklace carved in the likeness of Epona. Like that enigmatic goddess, she smiled and accepted congratulations, finally pleading a sore elbow in order to leave before midnight. An hour later, wearing a groom's overall, she was hacking down the dark road to the spaceport on Max, whose alert ears and brisk movement revealed that the horse, at least, thought this was a fine idea. If anyone asked, her ground car was parked in the stable lot, and everyone knew that she was likely to have gone to the stables to end the night celebration there. Colum had had Max saddled for her. An extra hack would do that one no harm, but had been out of sight when she led the horse out. 5 kilometers away, where a service road met the tracks of A course, Phase C, Dale waited with the truck and trailer, in which a horse stamped its impatience. Roz had driven her own battered little ground car. Cecilia swung off Max, helped load him in the trailer beside Dulcie. Max could be difficult to load in an empty trailer, then struggled with the car's cranky driver's side door. Roz slammed it from outside and climbed into the truck. Ceci drove off alone to the regional airport. For Cecilia, the advantage of piloting her own ship was that her flight plan and her actual destination need have nothing to do with each other. She had discussed with her staff the training schedule for Seniority and Max for the rest of the season and told them she was going to visit Equisite's lab before returning to Rotterdam to check on a new gene sculpting technique only recently applied to horses. Then she filed a flight plan for Rotterdam, knowing that her staff would not comment. Her new planet-to-jump craft allowed her to bypass Zenebra's crowded station. She expected Pater to check on her flight plan and her jump vector. Fine, let him check. The exit vector for Rotterdam actually led to the first intermediate jump point, and from there she could route to Castle Rock easily. She spared a moment to thank Harris for suggesting that she get a license and learn to pilot her own craft. Pounce had more speed than her old yacht, as well as the ability to land on planet. She was past the orbital station now, following the beacons out to the system's jump point. 2 uneventful transits after leaving Zenebra, Cecilia was in Castle Rock's near space, confirming that Miranda was still on planet and still in residence in the old palace. When she called, the staff person who answered reported that Miranda would indeed be willing to see her. Cecilia made her shuttle reservation while waiting for the station tug to bump her gently into the docking harness. The paperwork necessary to clear the Rockhouse Major Dockmaster and Customs seemed to take forever. But she made her shuttle with a few minutes to spare. She saw no one she knew on Rockhouse Major and no one familiar on the down shuttle. That suited her. She was in no mood to talk to any of her acquaintances. But when she came out of the shuttleport entryway looking for a hire car, she saw one of the long black official cars with the familiar seal on the doors, and the driver clearly recognized her.
Lady Cecilia?
Yes?
Lady Miranda sent us for you. Your luggage?
In the dump. Cecilia handed over the ID strip. The driver nodded to his second, who took the strip and went off toward the dumps. Belatedly, Cecilia wondered if she should make sure of their identity and authorization. Harris, she thought, would be scolding her, if Harris were here. But the driver was now holding out a flat packet.
Lady Miranda wanted you to have this first.
Cecilia opened it. A flat pick of the driver and assistant, and a note from Miranda.
You may not be worried, but we have learned we must all take precautions. I look forward to seeing you.
In minutes, the assistant was back with Cecilia's few pieces of luggage, all marked with the striped tape that meant they'd passed customs. Cecilia got into the car and wondered, as it shot forward into traffic, if they were taking the same route Bunny had followed the day he was killed. She didn't ask.